Good evening. Echoes of the violent radical underground of the 1960s rolled over the New York suburb of Nanuet today in the botched ambush of an armored car that left one guard and two policemen dead.
It's October 1981, 11 years since the townhouse explosion. Terry, Diana, and Ted are dead. But what about the two women who got away?
They've been underground, in hiding, all this time. Until one day, one of them resurfaces.
223, all cars and stations stand by for one arm on an armed robbery. Just a car, Nanuet Mall.
After all those years on the run, Kathy Boudin gets caught in an armed robbery. It changes the course of her life forever.
That morning of the Brinks robbery, we heard this news report on the radio about three white people and X number of black people had been arrested attempting to carry out a robbery of a Brinks truck. And we just looked at each other and said, this has got to be our friends. And sure enough, it was.
This is Shoe Leather, an investigative podcast that digs up stories from New York City's past to find out how yesterday's news affects us today. This season, we're going to 1970 Greenwich Village. A townhouse suddenly explodes, and authorities find out that it's ground zero for the operations of the Weathermen, a radical group of young revolutionaries who used violence to bring the war home.
Kathy Boudin is our fourth member of the Weathermen, the one who was in the shower when the explosion happened. She ran, still naked, into a neighbor's house. An older lady gives her clothes, a hot cup of tea, and tells her to wait until the ambulance arrives. But Kathy knows she has to keep on running. She sneaks out of the house, onto the street, and down into the subway. She disappears underground for almost a decade.
We know very little about that time. We know she got married, she had a son, she had panic attacks. It seemed she held on to her radical politics. One day, the police finally catch up to her. And that's where we'll start.
I'm Justine Streichenberger.
And I'm Aaliyah Gatto. This is Shoe Leather Season 7, Revolution Gone Wrong. You're listening to Episode 5, The Prisoner.
Rockland County is a quiet area around 20 miles north of Manhattan. It's where we met Bob Van Cura, the undersheriff.
Thank you so much for meeting with us.
You had a good day to drive up, right?
Yeah, it was beautiful.
It's not too far.
No, we stopped for a bagel and coffee.
He shows us around the Rockland County Police and Public Safety Academy. Bob's been in law enforcement for 45 years. He grew up in this town. In October 1981, he was a brand new police officer. And that's when one of the biggest crimes to hit Rockland happened.
I heard it on the radio. I just happened to have a police scanner who was nearby, and I heard it.
The problem at Nanuet National in the mall, our armored truck was shot at.
And that's what precipitated, you know, my going to the scene.
At 3:55 p.m., a Brinks armored truck stops at the Nanuet National Bank. It's making its last cash pickup of the day.
Two guards go into the bank, get the money. The driver stays with the truck, secured in the front of the truck.
But then, something goes wrong.
There were several male blacks that jumped out of the back of that van, engaged the Brinks guards, killed them as they were loading the money into the back of the truck.
Three robbers in ski masks get out of a red car. They shoot at the guards, one guard at the front of the truck and one at the back.
Yeah. I'm gonna need an ambulance. He just yelled out, I need an ambulance.
The robbers are armed with automatic weapons. They blast a massive hole into the Brinks truck's windshield. It's supposed to be bulletproof.
So that is that windshield there.
Wow.
Bob points to a display case where we're standing. There's a shattered piece of glass with a hole inside.
Those are huge.
That's massive.
You could fit your fist in there.
As one of the gunmen holds up the bank, the two others raid the truck. They grab as many cash bags as they can. and drive off with $1.6 million.
About half a mile east, the robbers grab the bags of money and jump into the back of a U-Haul. In the passenger seat of the U-Haul is Kathy Boudin. The car switch is designed to trick the police so they can drive back to New York. What they don't know is that the police have set up a roadblock, checking every car trying to get onto the highway. Then, they spot their suspects.
U-Haul truck right here.
A man and a woman driving a U-Haul truck. They can't let them get away.
Just make sure that U-Haul truck doesn't get on the throughway, Brian. We'll pull them over as soon as we can find them.
At 4:06 p.m., they stop the U-Haul to question them.
What happened was Officer Brown and Detective Keenan went around the back of the U-Haul and then tried to open the door, and they couldn't get the door open. And so Detective Keenan kind of went back to the front of the truck to tell Sergeant O'Grady that, hey, I can't, the thing's locked. Let's get them to unlock it. And Officer Brown stayed back there because when the door went up, you know, they started firing and he was right there.
I got a guy wounded and somebody's been hit.
You got these guys with M16 rifles that are firing out of the back of this U-Haul truck and spraying bullets.
The first officer is shot dead.
He was killed almost instantly. Detective Keenan had taken, he had come back and taken cover behind one of these trees and was exchanging fire, and he got hit while he was there.
The second officer is wounded.
Two officers have been shot.
And the third officer runs out of bullets.
And went down to reload, and he was shot and killed there.
Only one of the officers makes it. The two others are killed. As the bullets are flying back and forth, Kathy tries to escape. But that's when an off-duty police officer catches her. And after 11 years of running, it's game over for Kathy Boudin.
In the 70s, the Weather Underground continued to wage a war against the U.S. government. They planted bombs in federal buildings, police headquarters, the Pentagon, the Capitol. The aim was never to hurt anyone, merely awaken American consciousness. There was a looming atmosphere of fear and anxiety. They were bringing the war home.
The Brinks robbery marks a shift. If the townhouse explosion was the cautionary tale of young revolutionaries ready to die for the cause, this was different. They could kill for it. The robbery is a joint operation between the members of the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army, the BLA for short. It will lead to one of New York State's most notorious and expensive trials.
These groups have a reputation for prison breaks, so they need maximum levels of security. Ultimately, Rockland County will have to pay $5 million for the trial costs. The publicity surrounding the trial means that it has to move locations to Orange County, about 30 miles away.
Because it was had such an impact in Rockland County, the defense argued that they couldn't get a fair trial here, that everybody was, you know, overcome really with fear and anxiety over the whole thing, that they couldn't find impartial jurors in Rockland County to hear the case.
In total, 11 people are charged and put on trial. Many of them decide to defend themselves. They're not successful. It takes the jury only 4 hours to convict them of armed robbery and murder. They're sentenced to 75 years in prison.
But Kathy, she has a different strategy.
She was an educated woman. She had a, you know, a successful family. She was able to...
Kathy's father is Leonard Boudin. He's a big-time civil rights attorney. So big, he represented Fidel Castro.
Kathy was, as a very, very active participant in the civil rights movement.
That's Leonard speaking to an interviewer collecting oral histories of influential American legal figures.
I don't think I would ever discourage Kathy's involvement in political activities.
Leonard's law firm takes on Kathy's case. One of his partners defends her in court. The strategy? Denial. She admits she helped facilitate the robbery but she says she had nothing to do with planning it. And her lawyer used this very same strategy for the townhouse explosion.
There was no evidence connecting Kathy Boudin to that bomb. And it's always been accepted by law enforcement that Kathy Boudin had nothing to do with that event.
She also admits that her thinking was so distorted that she didn't even think anything could go wrong. Here's what she told WNYC Radio.
I took my son to the babysitter and assumed that I would be back to pick him up later in the day. It's hard to imagine that, and yet I think the way in which denial can work is that you literally can block out consequences.
Rather than going to trial for three murder charges, she cuts a deal.
In White Plains, New York, Kathy Boudin, the former Weather Underground fugitive, pleaded guilty to murder and robbery in the 1981 holdup of a Brinks armored car.
In April 1984, after 3 years of legal battles, Kathy pleads guilty to first-degree robbery and second-degree murder.
Kathy Boudin, formerly a key figure in the radical Weather Underground, was sentenced today to 20 years to life in prison.
There is another part to the deal. At the sentencing, her lawyer convinces the judge that if Kathy is a model prisoner, then she can be released. For some of Kathy's friends who we spoke to, this guilty plea is proof that Kathy regretted being part of the Brinks heist, that she knew she had gone too far. But for Bob and the people of Rockland County, well, they see it differently.
I think a lot of the people in the community, including me, felt like, you know, her 20-year-to-life sentence was kind of not enough for what happened.
Whether Kathy Boudin takes the deal because it's in her self-interest or because it's true confession of guilt is something we can't know. What is for certain is that it will define her experience both inside and out of prison. Kathy's time in prison is a new chapter in her life. She also develops lifelong relationships. She doesn't give up on her desire to fight for change, but she turns the page on violence. This is how she will try to redeem herself.
My name is Kathy Boudin. I'm serving a sentence of 20 to life for second-degree murder. I work in the parenting center with mothers and their children.
In a PBS documentary, Kathy is wearing a moss green prison shirt. Her hair is big, dark, down to her shoulders. Her eyes are deep set. The documentary she's in, What I Want My Words to Do to You, is about a group of imprisoned women in a series of writing workshops.
I feel like I've spent a lot of time in the last, 10 years, 13 years, trying to figure out why I did what I did. I know this is going to sound completely trite. I think the truth is complicated, and it's probably a mix of things.
Kathy has now been in prison for 14 years. We wanted to know what she was up to, because remember, she needs to be a model prisoner if she ever wants a shot at getting out. So we went on a search for her prison records.
New York State Archives, how can I help you?
Hi there, my name is Aaliyah Gatto, and I'm calling because I'm...
The archivists tell us that Kathy's records are sitting in a box in a warehouse. In that box is over 1,000 pages of prison documents. Here's what we found. Within 2 years of being inside, Kathy gets a master's degree in education and eventually starts on a PhD. She gets commendations for articles she writes, courses she teaches, her commitment to the foster care, AIDS, and higher education programs. One poem wins her a Penn Prison Writing Award. She plays chess and softball. She even earns a black belt in karate.
When Kathy gets to prison, there's this shift that happens, not only for Kathy, but for how people view her. Norma Hill is one of the victims of the shootout on the day of the robbery. Here's how she remembers it.
I did see the two police officers get shot, and then one of the shooters saw me sitting in the car, which was right next to the truck, and he came over He put a gun in my face, and he pulled me out of the car, threw me on the ground, and took off with the car with my mother in it.
Norma spends 3 years testifying against Kathy and the other robbers in court. But decades later, she's completely turned around.
I did reacquaint myself with Kathy 10 years ago when we were both working on an AIDS project.
AIDS devastates prisons through the 80s and 90s. Norma's brother ends up dying from it. And when Norma goes to an AIDS awareness program at Bedford Hills, Kathy's prison, she and Kathy cross paths again.
From that day forward, I spent a great deal of time with Kathy Boudin, and there was never a moment during that time that she did not express her remorse. And she expressed it verbally, but I also think that she expressed it by the things that she did, by her actions in the prison system. And I do believe that because of her, there are women now that are outside the prison system that will never go back.
To Norma, Kathy is not the same violent radical that she was during the robbery. To many, she's become an example of redemption and justice.
So, by the time Kathy serves her minimum sentence, people are really divided over whether she should be freed. On one side, the friends of Kathy Boudin. Charlotte Phillips is a longtime friend of Kathy's.
We had a whole organization of friends of Kathy Boudin that was an unincorporated association, and we had a bank account.
On the other side, the Victims Impact Unit, the people whose lives have been upended by the Brinks robbery.
You know, they were all people, right? And it had an impact on a lot of people's lives.
These two forces will come to a head when Kathy is up for parole in August of 2001.
20 years later, the time has finally come. Kathy has a shot at getting out. Remember Kathy's plea deal? How her lawyer had convinced the judge to put on the record that if she was a model prisoner, she could be released? Well, Eleanor Stein, a longtime friend of Kathy's, told us something about that deal we couldn't forget.
That one sentence by the judge was a critical contributing element to her winning her freedom. That's just kind of an amazing example of what a great lawyer can do.
So this was the point where she has to show how all her work inside prison is proof that she deserves to get out. We found a collection of letters of recommendation that Kathy's lawyers put together in support of her parole application. One volunteer at Bedford Hills writes, quote, "I would say she has evolved, after 20 long years in prison, into an extraordinary woman of responsibility, empathy, and repentance."
And here's another letter from Eve Ensler, a famous playwright who led a writing workshop. Quote, "I can say with deepest conviction that not only would the world be safe with Kathy in it, but she would make it a better place." Norma. She was one of the victims of the Brinks heist who got to know Kathy. She ended up supporting her parole too.
I felt as strongly about Kathy being put into prison when I stood in the courtroom 22 years ago as I feel today that she should be released.
But there's just as fierce an opposition.
Kathy Boudin, in a way, represents the darkness of the 60s that young idealists could turn into monsters. Many family members of the victims still see a monster, and monsters, they say, belong in prison.
The son of one of the fallen police officers was vocal about his opinion on the radio.
There's no such thing as paying your debt to society when you take a life. There's no such thing.
Bob, the young cop who was on duty the day of the Brinks robbery, I asked him what he did.
So you opposed parole?
I did. And you know, I went to Bedford when we did some demonstrations when the governor was going to come and meet with her. There were several hundred people over there at the time protesting that. And then there were some rallies in NIAC itself trying to oppose it.
Others expressed their dissent in letters. the president of an NYPD organization representing over 1,900 members, calls Kathy Boudin the cop killer. And it wasn't just the police. Another woman writes, "Please do not consider letting her out. I do not want her in my community." It's in light of all these polarized views that the parole board finally releases their decision.
The national briefing tonight begins with a famous figure from the 1960s. The former radical Kathy Boudin was denied parole today. She was convicted for murder.
They ultimately decide that they're, quote, not satisfied that parole is appropriate at this time. Basically, they deny it. They explain that although it's clear she positively impacted the lives of many while in prison, her, quote, achievements are clearly outweighed by the serious and brutal nature of the crimes. This decision is a win for all of those who think of Kathy as representing the darkness of the 70s. Radical leftist revolutionaries who would stop at nothing. Traitors threatening American values, tearing down American institutions.
But Kathy challenges that decision. Her lawyer wants to keep going.
She not only behaved herself well in prison, she's been, by all accounts, an exemplary inmate.
It's that line from her sentence. It provides a window that she and her lawyer keep trying to pry open. If she's an exemplary inmate, that's grounds for early release. They go back two more times. In August 2003, Kathy goes in front of the parole board. The hearing lasts over an hour, and then they huddle and give out their decision.
The New York State Parole Board has ordered the release of Kathy Boudin yesterday.
So that's it. She finally gets released.
She immediately calls her lawyer.
She was joyous and crying and tearful and incoherent.
Her friends couldn't believe it.
The whole experience of her getting out, I mean, that was a big deal, her getting out of prison, because again, we never thought she would get out.
This is a major victory. Kathy is finally going to be free. All she has to do now is wait for the prison gates to open.
Kathy's trial has been so public, her parole so controversial, that her release has got to be carefully orchestrated.
The original idea was, let's have a whole lot of people come and welcome her when she walks out the door.
Kathy's friend Eleanor had hoped to greet her at the gates of Bedford, but that idea quickly changed.
The prison was trying to avoid a big press event, you know, with counter-demonstrators and things like that. I think they announced that she was going to be released on a certain day. And then 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe the day before, they just kind of hustled her out the back.
That doesn't stop Kathy's friends from celebrating her newfound freedom. They throw her a big dinner party.
It's the first day, so she was pretty dazed. And our friend is a fabulous cook. And she had a huge table. And I was sitting next to Kathy, and she gets this huge bowl of salad. And she starts eating the salad, and this look of absolute astonishment comes over her face. And she holds up her fork, and she says to me, "What is this?" And I said, "Kathy, that's arugula." She'd never heard of it. She'd never tasted it. And there it was. She was absolutely astonished.
Did she like it?
She loved it. She ate it every day for the rest of her life.
After prison, life goes on. First, Kathy gets a PhD at Columbia University. She eventually gets a job there. That move ignites a whole new debate. Jeanette Takamura is the dean of the School of Social Work at Columbia. She's the one who hired Kathy.
I didn't spend a lot of time wringing my hands over it.
Takamura sees a natural transition between Kathy's work inside and outside the prison. She believes that this hire is a testament to the school's faith in the potential for people to change and giving second chances. But the press is outraged.
terrorists from the Weather Underground are being allowed to teach at America's most prestigious universities across the country.
College campuses seem to be the last bastion of places where ex-cons can still be employed and become professors.
Kathy Boudin, she became a murderer. Then she was released from prison. Guess what happened to her? She was hired to teach students at Columbia University.
Are these really people that we want indoctrinating, teaching our children?
How does Kathy Boudin, involved in killing two police officers and an armed guard, how does she get to teach at Columbia?
It isn't just the press. Bob, the Rockland County Undersheriff, and other members of the community go to protest her hiring. Of course, Dean Takamura can't just ignore them.
But being a dean of the school presents all kinds of challenges, you know, that put me up against the question, you know, is this, what kind of decision does one make given the controversy or given the fact that some people could be very upset?
During her time at Columbia, Kathy co-founds the Center for Justice, an organization committed to ending mass incarceration. Today, Dean Takamura still stands by her decision all those years ago.
She was a positive force. You know, it was clear that she was doing something of value. It was clear that she was helping to redefine the impact of redemption. And, you know, and the fact that one could get beyond incarceration to becoming someone who could make an enormous contribution to society.
My name is Kathy Boudin. I did 22 years and I've been home for 13.
In 2015, Kathy is diagnosed with ovarian cancer. In the years that follow, she continues her work with the Center for Justice and other prison justice organizations. This is her speaking at another prison with the Women in Justice Project.
I'm someone that believes in hope, that hope is something that carries us and will carry us through this next period.
In May 2022, Kathy passed away. Today, the Center for Justice has a fund to commemorate her. It's called the Kathy Boudin Freedom Fund, and it awards fellowships to formerly incarcerated activists. And in Rockland County, there's another scholarship fund. It's named after Edward O'Grady and Waverly Brown, the two officers who were killed. It gives money to high school students looking to pursue a career in law enforcement. Without asking her ourselves, we can't really know how Kathy felt in the end. The closest we can come to is through her friends. Here's Charlotte again.
Do you think she felt that she had been able to redeem herself?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like she really, I think, never kind of forgave herself for the fact that people were killed. And I think as she kind of came closer to dealing with that, she never did really.
A true child of the 60s, Kathy had a penchant for the arts. Her preferred medium was poetry. Behind bars, it was her means of escape, her way of dreaming of a different world, one where she could make amends. In her own words,
I would not have my hands in any way touching the tragedy of that day. My journey cannot be taken without facing your eyes and those of your loved ones who went on with their lives without you. If only there were a place where the living and the dead could meet, to tell their tales, to weep. I would reach for you, not so that you could forgive me, but so that you could know that I have no pride for what I have done, only the wisdom and regret
that came too late.
On the next episode, we hear about another Kathy, Kathy Wilkerson, the fifth and final member of the townhouse explosion. And she's the only one who's still alive today. Shoe Leather is a production of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. This episode was reported, written, and produced by Justine Streichenberger and Aaliyah Gatto. Joanne Farian is our executive producer and professor. Rachel Quester and Peter Leonard are our co-professors. Special thanks to Austin Mitchell, Brendan Klickenberg, Asta Chaturvetti, Dana Shivas, Zoe Chase, Brent Katz, and Columbia Digital Libraries. Sources for this episode include documents, articles, and tape provided by the New York State Archives, the New School Archives and Special Collections, the Cleveland Public Library, PBS, and the Columbia Center for Oral History. Shoe Leather's theme music, Squeegees, is by Ben Lewis, Doran Zunes, and Camille Miller, remixed by Peter Leonard. Other music by Blue Dot Sessions. The graphics for this season were created by Hope Zhu.